the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, thanks for coming to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast on the CBP Media Network. Now, Len, even though we're called the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, and even though we named the media outfit after the show, you and I have tried our best to bring on guests we think add value. That's the point, right? Me and you talk to each other all the time. I'm not adding any value. You're not adding any value.
Hey.
That's what my wife tells me anyway. So I don't know. Maybe your wife says the same thing. But generally, that's a sentiment that I receive on
get
my end.
Get another third party to give you some guidance. That's not true. We add a tremendous amount of value.
Okay.
I'll let you go.
Okay. We got Mike Campbell here tonight. Money Talks. It's, I think, the largest syndicated show, business-wise or finance-wise, in the country. I don't want to misspeak. We'll let Mike talk about a little bit of his background and what he's got going on. Then we're going to get into a lot of Canadian economy, a lot of energy, a lot of tons of stuff. But first, Len. As always, we are sponsored by two great Canadian companies. One is ShakePay. It's the best place for you, Canadian listener, to buy or sell, if you want, Bitcoin. Lots of stuff going on there, Len. They got the Shaking Sats promotion. If you use our promo code to sign up, or any promo code, just sign up. You get $10 on your first $100, and you get to shake your phone every day for free Satoshis, which is great. They also have the Shake Paid program, where if you spend off of your CAD balance in the app with your Google Pay or Apple Pay or whatever, they might just comp you the whole thing, which is fantastic. They have the ShakePay Earn, which is in queue mode right now. We've all seen this before over the years, where if you keep a CAD balance, they'll pay you interest in Bitcoin, which is great. And we found out that it's paid from their marketing budget. So no exposure to any of these crypto Ponzi's going long on all God knows what kind of derivatives of derivatives you can get on Binance. And then they got some other stuff going on too, Len. I don't know. They got the Shaking Squads, where if you and four of your friends get together, you spend a little bit every day, you get a few Satoshis, and you build your stack that way. So great Canadian company. We love those guys. They've been with us a long time, and we hope to give them a shot. Who else we got, Len?
Ledin. So since you're buying some Bitcoin and you have it, well, why not put it on the Ledin platform and earn some interest? Open up an account with our referral code below and fund your Ledin account with 150,000 Satoshis or 75 USDC. Keep it on their platform for 15 consecutive days, and Ledin is going to reward you with 10 USDC. This is a great way to earn some interest on your BTC or USDC. Also, if you have some bills you got to pay, don't want to sell your Bitcoin, who does at this price? You could borrow against it. Ledin's there to help you out. 50% loan to value. The collateral is to Bitcoin. You're good to go. Also, if you are the eternal Bitcoin bull and you think the price is going up, well, they could help you out there with a B2X option where you could double up your Bitcoin stack. Time the market right, come in when it's low, get out when it's hot.
Easy.
Yeah, it's simple as that. Now you have some more Bitcoin on your balance sheet. And the last thing they do have is the Bitcoin-backed mortgages industry first. Got a lot of fanfare when it was first introduced, but not available in every jurisdiction. So take a look on their website where they're offering that. And since you're there, might as well check out what are the interest rates for the savings and the borrowing account. So yeah, that's it for Ledin.
Great companies, great sponsors, and a great guest tonight, Mike Campbell, joining us. Mike is, I don't know how often you do remote podcasts, Mike, and guest appearances, but that chair looks way better than the chair I got. Like, I'm sitting on something here, you know, from World War II. I don't know, Len. I've never even seen your chair, Len. Your chair might not even have a back on it, does it?
No. My chair is pretty nice. It cost a pretty penny, and not as good as Mike's, though, but still. It's still pretty good. Better than
we're doing. We're doing something wrong here, Mike. How are you, sir? What's going on? What's good over there in your neck of the woods?
Well, first of all, good to be with you. And there are no shortage of things to talk about. I mean, I was doing a couple of speeches in the last few weeks and saying, I can never remember a time when there's more stuff coming at us and hitting us directly. Now, people appreciate there's inflation out there. They appreciate that maybe the Canadian dollar's down. Oops, my trip to the U.S. just got more expensive. They appreciate, obviously, the energy story. You know, whether it's, out in Vancouver, $2.42 for gas. I know it's less if I'm in Calgary. Lethbridge, I think, is the best place to fill up, but still too far to drive for most people at $1.30. But we appreciate the gas. We haven't had our home heating bills come at us yet. People go to the grocery store. Oh, good. That's 11% higher than last year. But if you're buying specific items like fresh fruit, I mean, I need a mortgage for the blueberries that I eat. My point only being, when you're in a period of historic change, we shouldn't be surprised. I'll give you another one. As people who know me know, one of my favorite expressions, because I'm always pleading with people, please understand this stuff. And that's JP Morgan's. I mean, you don't have to pay attention to politics or economics or finance. The problem is they'll pay attention to you. So while people were not paying attention, oh, my house is worth $200,000 left. My house is worth $500,000 less. Oh, I took out a mortgage in 2017 at about 2.7, 2.8%. I'm renewing at 4.5%. I can't do the payments. My point is, as I said, I've never followed more stories, Russian sanctions and the impact there, the changing in currency markets. So yeah, it's an incredible time right now.
So you've been doing your show, Mike, for how long, Money Talks?
Oh, gosh. I'll do the quick math here. I think it's 1980 I started actually Money Talks. Before that, I did a show across the country called Money Matters. Clever names, as you can tell right away. You know, I was in a creative writing class and came up with those names. But 1980 right through 2022. So we're talking 40 years of this kind of stuff, but even longer. I mean, I'm an old guy, okay? I'll give you an example. I went to the Beatles when they went to Vancouver, when they came to Vancouver. That's 1964, and it was my first concert. But still, I mean, we're talking old.
So
you and Len can add your age together, and I'll still.
Closer to you than you think.
And I look younger than I am. You're longer in the tooth than us, Mike. But with that age comes experience. And the first question I want to ask you, okay, because you've been doing this a long time, and we have not, to be honest with you. And we, you know, I come from with a Bitcoin slant, the Canadian slant, and presumably you've seen many instances where, you know, global economies were quote unquote in turmoil. Let's say there was a new catalyst for energy in markets or energy in the population or energy in politics. And we're seeing that now. And one of the things I keep hearing from our guests and from my friends and family and from people I work with, et cetera, is this is no different than this time, or there was high rates this other time, or we've seen a nuclear escalation that went, our way another time over here, another time over here. What do you think is different about what we're seeing now? And maybe if you have a view on this, what do you think is the same?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have to be careful what variables are most important. So what's similar is most people have the same two arms, two legs. You know, so you can always create a similarity. You know, men are still wearing pants and others are wearing pants. I mean, I don't want to get any there, but you know what I mean? So you have to really look at the variable. And the big variable that's different is sovereign debt. So I hear about people making comparisons with the 1970s with the rate of change with inflation. No, the difference is the sovereign debt compared to the economy is so much bigger. Pension problems are so much larger. The promises we've made about our pensions and the amount of money we've set aside, well, nothing's ever been in this ballpark. So it's a leveraging in the system that makes it a problem. And that's what problem is, by the way, for the central banks. You know, we can sort of do a 1-minute interview. And the interview is this. They're sitting there going, gee, if I keep raising rates to fight inflation, will I crush the government? Will I actually bring the system down? And last week, we got a sniff. You know, the answer was, you know, so can they keep on raising rates? Well, the Bank of England said no last week. Like, I don't think many people get that we're at a systemic level here. You know, that people have, there's just all sorts of aspects to it, but the amount of money borrowed is just so dangerous. It creates such stress in the system. And so people can compare to the 1970s with inflation. No, didn't have anywhere near the sovereign debt problem. And that's the big difference here.
So yeah, the debt to GDP ratio is much, much higher now than it was in the 80s. And they're trying to make comparables back between now and back then and how they handled the inflation versus now. It's two worlds apart. And this extra debt that we're carrying, is you mentioned, is causing issues with pensions, and servicing the debt is even more costly. Every time they rise the rates, any newly created debt, well, it's more costly to deal with it. So I want to hear your thoughts about how is the debt to GDP ratio and all the debt that we have, I want you to run with this. How is this a real problem that we have to deal with, and how can we deal with it if at all possible?
Oh, well, first of all, let me just say the parliamentary budget officer, Yves Giraud, came out last week and saying because of this rise in interest rates, The projected debt servicing in 2025 will be $46 billion, double what it is today. So, you know, we say words like billions, millions, trillions, like they roll off our tongue. And they are. They're incomprehensible, the differences. So, but people should sort of get, man, does that ever restrict what we're going to do? I'm going to be paying taxes just so we can pay interest on the debt that we accumulated, especially in the last couple of years. So that's one thing. It limit, you know, the size of the debt just limits our options. And I'm afraid that there's only one way out of this, and that is going to be we're going to have an accident. So last week in Great Britain, again, it's relevant because it could be take place everywhere. I don't think people got that we're talking about the pension system in Great Britain was collapsing last week, like literally collapsing. And so the reason is they had bought bonds, and people should understand as interest rates go up, the value of my bond, and that's easy to get. Like I got my bond's paying me 2%. Gosh, and interest rates have gone to 5. Nobody wants my 2% bond anymore. And hence, in order to get them to buy it from me, I've got to reduce the price. I've got to say, well, okay, it matures at $100, but I'll sell it to you at 70. I'll sell it to you at 60. And actually, the numbers that we can use today, when we get a 5-year bond is 3.5% right now, paying in interest of 3.5. Inflation, the last number we got was 7%. So if the bond was going to pay interest just to equal inflation, that $100 or $1,000 bond, oh, I got to give it to you $440. That's a heck of a loss. That's the point to get here. And the point, why is it so important? It's because a world's awash in debt. I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars will be wiped off. Well, wait a sec. What does that do to my bank? What does it do to my central bank? What does it do here? That's why I think this environment we're in is so different. We issued all these bonds in the last, say, 2-3 years at record low rates in that ballpark. Inflation's considerably higher. No one in their right mind takes 3% coupon when I got a 7% inflation rate because I'm losing money at 4% a year. So that's what people have to wrap their head around. So in Great Britain, it hit their pension funds. The losses were huge. And then we had the government turn around and say, hey, we're going to have a bailout for energy of over £100 billion. Well, you're just printing that money up. All that happened is people said, you're making inflation go higher, not lower. I'm out of this bond. I'm not taking this bond anymore. So they started to sell. Well, there were no buyers. That's the biggest worry we've got. There were no buyers. The Bank of England stepped in and became the buyer. By the way, same thing's happening in Japan. So you're talking about the big four, you know, euro, UK pound, Japanese yen, US dollar. Okay, well, we've got two of them in dire straits right now. Japan is in, you know, they've got the lowest currency rate versus the US dollar to, I think, at a 24-year low. Pound is a 37-year low. You know, we got the euro under par now with the US dollar. This is Bitcoin stuff, by the way, writ large. This is exactly what motivates a lot of people. I can't be, you know, specific on every single person who likes Bitcoin, but that's been a lot of the motivation for Bitcoin. We don't trust your currency. We don't trust your government. So I'm looking for an alternative that protects me against a 37% drop in my UK pound, you know, and the level of manipulation that we're experiencing. So it's all coming back to the monetary system. And I mean, gosh, how would you like to be in Turkey? You've watched energy rates go up significantly, right? But my lira has gone down 50% against the currency they measure oil in, dollars. Well, not doable. I mean that literally, not doable. And there's so many. I've counted about 100 countries that have got their currency, their paper dollars, collapsed. You know, and I mean, we know about Argentina. We know about Venezuela. We know about Ecuador. We know about Bolivia. The list is just longer and longer. That's a monetary crisis. And I think, and again, I'm no expert on Bitcoin, and I'm not pretending I know what millions of owners are doing. They're looking at that and it worries them. They're looking at the manipulation of the currency, the printing of the press. It's all the same stuff and we're dealing with it.
We are looking at that, Mike. And one of the things you mentioned there, I want to pull on that thread a bit, the PBO. One of the things that to me is, you know, it's not like a lack of faith per se, but I look at the inability of the PBO as far as their arm's length designation that I keep on hearing they have, right? The same way the Central Bank of Canada has got an arm's length designation from the sitting government. When you mention PBO stats, do you think about, is this really true? Are these guys spinning this in a way that's going to be favorable to the regime at the moment? Is this a number I can count on as an investor, as a business analyst like you are? Or do you look at that with a skeptical lens? Because I think we do. We talk about this kind of stuff quite a bit, and we'll talk about the pensions after, but I'm curious, the PBO and other arm's length institutions, are these not really just, you know, stenographers for the state, more or less, right?
Sorry, enough about the CBC. Let's talk about it. Just kidding. But I mean, like throughout the world, when you start getting governments overwhelming their central banks, you know, influence wise, that's how you get hyperinflation. That literally is why I know people talk, oh, gee, they're printing up a lot of money. That is not the correlation with hyperinflation. It's the loss of confidence in the paper currency. And it comes from the central bank and the government getting together, kind of. And there's lots of examples of that. In our own case, in Canada's case, no, I think the parliamentary budget officer is independent. And the reason is the number of critical reports he has to the government. You know, the government does not want them putting out reports for everybody who said, don't run up that deficit. You're going to have a problem. And then he comes out and says, yeah, we're going to have a problem. It's, you know, it's double that. Bank of Canada has been interesting. I've been more cynical, let's say, toward the Bank of Canada. And I'll tell you a few things why. Up in, you know, this time last year, the Bank of Canada was telling us inflation was transitory. Well, again, people want to look at the Russian invasion, which exacerbated energy problems, exacerbated, did not create them. Already in Great Britain, their electrical bills were up 1,200%. They didn't anticipate the wind not blowing in the North Sea. Oh, we don't have backup power. So we've got to get coal again and stuff like that, and we have to import it. That created huge price inflation well before you know, what was happening in Ukraine, you know, whatever it was, February 24th, when the invasion started, and before that, let's give them credit, but it was months before. Yeah. So, and then right through to December, they're still telling us it's transitory. And I'm going, seriously, are we talking economics 101? The government has just created a $508 billion deficit in 2 years. We have a supply chain problem. We know that we have excess savings because we were restricted in our purchases. And you're telling me you're surprised they're going up in value? You know, we had a commodity bull, you know, that first leg of the bull run. And you're so every input is going up. And I'm going, I sincerely thought at the time, like, either you're an idiot and I don't want to call some, I don't want to call someone a name, but I'm saying this was so fundamental. We were seeing, I mean, keep it, and people sort of forget, oh gosh, this time last year we were complaining about gas prices and we were complaining right through November. You didn't think that was going to translate to higher prices somewhere? And for some, if you thought that the energy problem was going to be relieved, then I'm not sure what you're smoking. There's a structural problem in energy. We have an increase in demand. No one's investing in energy. You know, I'm talking about companies. Why? Because they say it takes 10 years to get a project off the ground. The government's told me we're not having that product in 10 years. Like all of it comes together. But so when you ask, were they influenced? I just don't have an explanation how they would have missed, let's say, really obvious numbers by March of last year, March, April period. But let's go give them another few months to wake up. Okay, we're still in December. And they're still telling me it's, you know, now it's not transitory. And even then they didn't say it's sort of long term. So I don't know what that was about. So I don't know to the degree. I do know that I'll listen to a press conference by Tiff Macklin, the head of the Bank of Canada, 10 times before I'll listen to any politician. Like they do tell their, you know, they sort of give us as best they can. But I have my suspicions about the inflation call.
I'm wondering if you use that for sleeping material more than anything else, because when I listen to Tiff, it's more just it's putting me to sleep. And there was a series of tweets from the Bank of Canada not too long ago. They were just simply gaslighting us, saying that if we willed inflation to be here, it will simply be here.
Unreal.
It's not the fact that they created a whole bunch of new liquidity that's in the market, but that's beside the point. You touched upon energy. Is there anything Canada is doing right? And what are they doing wrong with respect to energy policy?
Well, I think the wrong part is that, there's just so many things that come to mind when you say that. Let me start with this. we thought there could be a renewable transition in 15 minutes. We listened to a teenager from Europe give us the advice, by 2025, we're in trouble, 2030. They never had a practical plan, not one. I'm not arguing, I'm not debating climate change. I never need to. I'm saying, okay, fine. You tell me you want to build a house. Forgive me for asking where the lumber's coming from, where the nails are coming from. The most heat I ever took on Money Talks in terms of blowback was when I started to ask that question about 3, 4, 5 years ago. Oh, excuse me. Yes, renewable. I'm not arguing with you. Hey, where are you getting the copper from? Where are you getting the lithium from? Where are you getting the cobalt from? Oh, maybe we can get more of that cobalt, by the way, because it's child labor in the Congo, you know, or maybe we can get more of those solar panels because it's made with slave labor in Xinjiang province in China. No, they didn't like any of that kind of talk. I was just looking for, give me a practical, measurable plan, because it was no way it was going to happen. A copper mine takes, go talk to the people in the industry, 7 years, 10 years, you know. Well, we knew we didn't have enough copper. This wasn't debatable. We knew we didn't have the nickel. We knew we certainly don't have the lithium, you know, let alone some of the technological things, let alone, by the way, if you are doing real mining, how do you think those machines run? Have you ever seen one in a real
solar
mine?
Solar. They run on solar. Yeah. Everyone knows that.
So it was so, I've asked this question many times, though. How did we allow something so impractical, so unrealistic, to be accepted without question, without critical thought, you know, because this was not difficult stuff to say, you need copper. Oh, how much do we have right now in the world? How much will we need? These weren't sophisticated questions. And yet we went for, you know, 1-2 decades without asking anything. That's what's come home to roost in the energy market, that you can't, we don't have a grid anywhere close to ready. And I think we should have invited those questions. I have a couple of friends who are very concerned about climate change. So I say to them, you should be asking those questions, not me. If you think this is the solution, you should be asking those questions. And we still, if you think about it, in this country today, we don't know where the rare earth minerals are coming from, you know, to do this. We don't know where any of those other major minerals are coming or the resources are coming. We haven't noticed that all the refinery of virtually all of that stuff is coming out of China. Oh, we've just seen how strategic power works, you know, with the energy market in Russia. There's just nothing practical about it. So the idea that you could eliminate fossil fuels in 5 or 10 or 20 years even is unrealistic. But they did. They discouraged. You know, I've often said this because I'm old fashioned. I'm old. I believe in accountability. We have people who have led incredibly dangerous aspects here. It was dangerous to say we don't need fossil fuels. Don't you dare invest in new production. That's what we're living. 7 years of no new production. Who in their right mind would make that investment that takes, as I say, something like 7 years to manifest, maybe 10, to just get into the production mode when they tell us, oh, guess what? In 7 to 10 years, we're not using your product. That's why we have no new refinery capacity. We had Mike Wirth, who's CEO of Chevron, say there will not be another refinery built in the U.S. in his lifetime. It makes no economic sense. Well, here's something that always surprises people when I tell them, you know, you've never bought crude oil, right? And they kind of look at me. Why are you concerned with the crude oil price? Your problem's refined products. You buy the refined products. You might take advantage of jet fuel, you know, obviously diesel, obviously gasoline, home heating oil. These are all refined products. You know, propane for my barbecue in the summer. All of that stuff are refined products. And just none of it was thought through. That's my complaint. So when people want to send me a little hate mail, send it because I asked for critical thinking. Send it because I asked for practical approach. I was never debating what they were saying. I was just saying, what's practical here? What's been exposed is how impractical they were, how unrealistic they were.
You know, Mike, a friend of our show and a friend of your show as well, Doomberg, has a great quote that if you're one of these people who thinks that renewables are going to replace, you know, gasoline in the next 10 or 15 years, even, you're either a victim of this sort of green propaganda or you're an architect of it. And so, you know, one of the things you mentioned earlier is, how do we get people to understand this? What is the mechanism through which, you know, guys like us, I almost don't even want to put us in the same category, Mike. You're a star. We're guys in our basement. But no. the other piece of this puzzle is how do we communicate this to people? because it seems like, as you mentioned, people don't, they, you know, in your interview with Luke on the weekend, people, when you ask someone where the food comes from, they say the grocery store. Where's the gas come from? The pump. These are elementary school answers, and you're getting them from adults and politicians and economists. And so what do we do? What's the next logical step here in getting the median voter, let's say, to understand these things and start thinking about them when they go to the ballot box or thinking about them with their friends or their jobs, whatever? What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, the price is going to get their attention. We have to get their attention first. I think Canadians, now this is a broad generalization, I could only supply anecdotal evidence, but it seems like Canadians are very complacent. You know, we do take a lot of stuff for granted. We've been lucky in our country, hugely, like, we sat by and said nothing when $150 billion worth of resource projects were canceled. Now, here's my point. I'm not saying they shouldn't have been. I'm saying we should have asked, what did we get in return? Oh, you're canceling that $15 billion project. Oh, what are we getting? I mean, where else in our life do we fork over a huge amount of money and not ask, what do I get? The guy shows up at the store and says, that'll be $150. You'd go, well, what are we getting for that? So I don't think it's because we're stupid. I think because we're not paying any attention whatsoever, because we think energy always just shows up. We think food just shows up. Well, you're starting to get people's attention. I had a great interview, I guess it's a couple of months ago, with a farmer out of Saskatchewan. And I just needed to hear, what's it like? Your diesel costs just went up. Your fertilizer's gone crazy. I mean, I'd like to, you know I was talking about money talks, the rise in fertilizer costs, because a year ago, one of my favorite things to put money in was ammonia. Why? Because ammonia is out of natural gas. And they were saying, don't produce natural gas. We already had shortages show up in the summer of a year, you know, of 2021. And I knew, well, there goes your ammonia price. I didn't have to be very bright. All I had to do is understand that natural gas produces ammonia and urea, and that produces nitrogen-based fertilizer. Now, I don't think you necessarily have to know that, because you're not making policy. I'm saying the people making policy have been astoundingly stupid. Like, I don't know. You tell me the adjective when a person in power doesn't get that the wind doesn't blow every day. Like, who doesn't? My grandchildren know that, you know. Gee, do you think the wind blows every day and the sun? Well, what will you do when it doesn't? They didn't have a plan. Like, it's that astounding level. I've never, and maybe it's recency bias, I can never think of equivalents to this. Like, this isn't philosophical. You're not saying, I believe in big government and I believe in small government, or I say I'm a capitalist, you say, well, I'm a socialist. This isn't at that level. That's not the level of saying, what do we do when the wind doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, you know, sun doesn't shine. You know, that's what's astounded me in this whole thing, you know. And you mentioned Doomberg. Well, I think he's done, that group has done wonderful work, especially on these relationships, like fertilizer, natural gas, farms, you know, kind of thing. So I they're a great group, but, and many others have been pointing to this, but it's just, I have no explanation why our politicians, there's a line by the late PJ O'Rourke, and I'll just bastardize it a little bit, but he says, nowadays we have politicians willing to do anything to save the climate except read a research report. And that's true. I mean, how don't you know the if you're making policy, let me emphasize that. How do you know that relationship? And there's so many others. How didn't you know you needed backup power? That's the one that kills me. And that's what got us into the Ukrainian mess, is Germany literally, we'll decommission the nuclear power plants. Oh, how are you replacing the power? Oh, we don't know. You know, well, I think we'll go to Russia. Well, President Obama said, don't do that. President Trump said, don't do that. Remember when they went into Georgia in 2008? Remember when they went into Crimea 2014? Mm-hmm. Last year, they're talking to Merkel. You know, there's just such a mess in the energy market. It's astounding. Sorry, one last thing. Mm-hmm. I warned you I'd go on and on, but I have to do this.
No problem.
That's what you're here for, Mike. What is this? Is this news that we need energy? Because they act like it. Is this news to anybody that your life changes without energy?
I don't know if it's news, but the thing that drives me batty, I'm 35. And so I have friends now who you know, 10 years ago would have been in that green camp without any understanding of the relationship between, you know, exploration, refinery, price of the pump, exploration, refinery, price at, you know, to heat your home, et cetera, et cetera. But at my age now, most people have it. The problem, Mike, is that the messaging, in my view anyway, is not targeted to me or to Len or to you. It's targeted to people who are younger than us. And I you know, everything those guys and girls hear is from CBC, from their professor at university, from, you know, maybe they're uneducated and you know, friends subject to this kind of stuff. So it concerns me a bit, but anyway, I mean, that it's all interesting stuff. I'm always, you know, interested to hear other people's take on where we went wrong and how we fixed it. But I know Len's got a follow-up here, it looks like. So go ahead there, buddy.
Well, just to piggyback off what you're saying, a lot of people, you know, they have these phones in their pocket and they have no idea how it got there. And they just kind of put their blinders on. They don't give a crap what about that. But with respect to energy, and we've talked about this in our show, Canada and even North America, we're blessed with so many natural resources. And I'm actually a nerd. I listened to the House of Commons. I listened to Question Period. And there was actually
shame
talk
on you.
This
shame
past
on
week.
You.
Shame on me, of course, that somebody, one of the MPs was saying that the strawberries grown locally to him cost more than the ones that they have to get grown from Mexico and shipped over to Ontario because of the fact we have these excessive taxes here. Now they're talking about increasing carbon tax. And we hear it's three times it's going to be higher than what it is now. It could be a talking point. And so I'm not going to really say if it is truly three times. But with respect to all this and the fact that we're turning away our backs from all this energy, is it too late to do investments? I mean, namely Keystone Pipeline, Keystone XL and stuff along those ilk. Is it just too far gone? Are we in for a decade-long series of like very expensive energy? Or is there still hope in the air that we could find some resolution here and work our way forward?
Just a couple of quick things. One is that our perspective is too often about what happens in the Western world. And I'm proud to say that I lived in India for over a year, but I'm proud to say that going back early in the pandemic, I said, your issue isn't us when it's going to be what happens in India, what happens in Brazil. Same thing. I mean, it was an embarrassment, the COP25 and COP26. They acted like India didn't exist. And they literally did. I mean, Prime Minister Modi said that after the thing. He's not signing on. This is horse manure. This is for urbanites living in the Western world, you know. So we have underestimated the incredible demand that's going to come out of the emerging markets. They are not going to be satisfied with leaving their people in poverty. And the relationship between energy use and poverty is direct. The more energy you get to maintain and manipulate in your life, the higher your standard of living, the higher your economy. So we're sitting there and we have not anticipated the demand that's coming out of Asia, Africa, South America as these countries develop. Well, again, going back to what we mentioned earlier, there's nobody increasing production. You know, nobody, at least in the West, is saying, I'm going to invest $10 billion in a new project. So these shortages that we're experiencing, we can go up and down in some small things as economy, like China is 2 billion barrels waiting to happen in demand. When they finish the lockdown stuff and in quotes go back to at least normal economic cycle, 2 million barrels a day. Where's it coming from? We already know that OPEC, not only did they cut back, they can't meet their own quotas anyways. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to figure out exactly how many barrels of oil are getting taken away from the market. Because if they're reducing 2 million barrels per day from their quotas, well, that ain't much because they weren't meeting the quota. I mean, there's been lots of talk. They can't just ramp up. Because each one of these, my goal when I'm talking and stuff, I don't want to dumb it down and mislead people ever. So I'm a terrible interview because believe me, I've got 627 facts floating in my head and I spit them all out. And I do get that. I mean, it's a running joke at our house. Don't ask me a question because I will give you an answer. But I'll say, sit down in that chair until I'm finished. No. So apologies for that. But there are so many aspects. Do we appreciate, we know that there's an energy shortage. I mean, I think that would be consensus. how many groups are fighting increasing energy right this minute? I was looking at a report of 163 lawsuits launched by environmental groups with the suspicion some of them are financed by China because they would, or Russia too, because they'd benefit, right? If we don't produce oil, guess what Russia's oil's worth? I mean, China right now is making a lot of money shipping their LNG up into Europe. Mm-hmm. So, but my point only being, what we do know is those environmental suits have stopped a heck of a lot of increase in, whether it doesn't matter, could be lithium mining, could be oil production, etc. We know right now in Europe, they could be doing shale. Now, I know Great Britain, by the way, changed and said, you can do shale again. I know that, but I'm saying most parts of Europe, they're saying you can't do that. Like, we haven't even committed to saying we will do something to get more energy. Maybe the most bright, the brightest spot is we started to see some coming back on the no nuclear mm-hmm. that we've seen, you know, like we know that Germany has been the last holdout, but now lots of talk that they're going to extend the life past. First of all, was, the last three were going to be shut down in December of this year. Okay. Then they said, we'll keep kind of standby right into April and it's going to extend. France, the same thing of the, but we see nuclear revival, South Korea, Japan, think about that after they had, their nuclear accident. That's positive. I don't see any other way to go but nuclear, because I think the oil and gas, you're just not going to get the capital investment needed to go forward.
It is clear nuclear is part of the solution. To touch on an earlier point you made, a friend of a friend of yours, actually, Eric Townsend, who hosts Macro Voices with Patrick Srezna, who works mm-hmm. works on Inside Edge, I think. He was saying today on Twitter that 2 million cut, as you mentioned, is from the quota, which is something that's kind of lost in the weeds and the headlines as has happened sometimes. The actual number of barrels per day is going to be about 800K. So sense. still a substantial cut, right? As these other economies, as you mentioned, China, for example, come back online. Mike, the other question I wanted to ask you about here before we move on. Well, we're going to move on actually from oil for a bit. The Canadian pensions and the general entitlements programs here in Canada. We did a semi deep dive on this on Monday, and when I was doing my research, I was looking at a few stats about what the chief actuary says about the sustainability of the pension, and how we're sort of weighing the sustainability against some of the baseline projections you would expect that the pension board comes up against when they're thinking about how much they can pay and what the inputs and outputs need to be. And I'm looking at things like life expectancy, immigration expectations, et cetera, et cetera. Do you know what the chief actuary says the pension plan is going to have under management as far as a percentage increase in 15 years? The actuary says they're good for a 3x in AUM in the next 15 years. So I don't know if that's true. You can talk about that. And one other things we looked at were, this sort of curve against the population. And I want to know your view on this, because I think you would have a lot to say. If I look at the Canadian job market, I think we came up with the number, Len, of all the Canadians employed, about 20% work for what could be considered a public service. They get a government paycheck. Yeah, they get a government paycheck. Healthcare, teaching, public service, whatever. Is the pension system here, I know you kind of touched on it earlier, but I'd love to hear you go deep. Is the pension system here as volatile, more volatile even, and more exposed to the current economic conditions than the UK is? My view is that it is. I'd love to hear yours.
Well, we don't leverage in our pensions to the degree they did in the UK, but the pensions are going to be a huge issue. And I'm proud to say I started to do stuff on that in 2018, but not saying today, I was saying 2023. That's when we'd start seeing it. Unfunded pensions, that, and again, just bring everybody at the same speed. An unfunded pension means they've promised to pay me X amount of dollars and they have not set the money aside for it. So then they have to estimate what their returns will be. Like they have stocks, they have some real estate, they have private equity, they've got bonds, and they have to estimate what is the return I'm going to get to see whether they'll have enough money to meet the promises they've made. Okay, so that's, well, oh, now we got a problem. And it's very simple to understand. We've just had the worst year when it comes to 10-year bonds in history. Well, they're going to be full of 10-year bonds. They got losses in their bond portfolio, which is significant. Bad news. Oh, they've got huge losses in their stock portfolio. Bad news. Oh, they've got losses in their real estate portfolio. One of the first thing that jumped out at me when we started to have these declines and we project, by the way, you know, when we say something like, oh, we've been out of the market for 10 months, that means nothing. What that meant was I didn't like the risk. It happened to be the right call. That's all that was. I did not like the risk. And, you know, when I see Peloton trading at a level that suggests that everyone's going to have four bikes in their home, I don't think you have to have a lot of smarts to say, hey, be careful, you know. So, but the point for pensions is it's been dreadful for bonds, dreadful for stocks, dreadful for private equity. Illiquidity is a problem, dreadful for real estate. Well, wait, they have to make, and again, they'll have their own projections of 6 or 7% every year. Well, now we're a little bit behind the eight ball. The U.S. has an $8 trillion problem right now. Think about that. $8 trillion, a number I can't comprehend. You know, Illinois is, why don't they just say we're not paying you? You know, our pension plan isn't going to work. What's going to be fascinating is the next step in that. So what happens when government pensions have a problem? And not everyone is the same shape because their underlying performance would be better. But what happens? I say the government bails them out. They've proven they're willing to print money to do that. Just like, you know, their bonds aren't going broke. People think, oh, the bonds are going to go broke. No, they're not. They'll just print money. So it's inflationary. And everywhere you look, I mean, the response has got to be government printed money. Isn't that what they've told us in the last 3 years? You know, that's what we're willing to do. So in the pension crisis, I see the same thing, that they will bail out with printed money if they have to. And Great Britain just did it. You know, that's the relationship. Oh, you need 65 billion pounds today, this hour? Oh, we'll get it for you. Again, that's the relationship with people's concerns and motivation for something like Bitcoin. It's the same motivation for people searching out gold. That's the commonality, is how do I protect my purchasing power? And it all comes from every one of these systems is broken now. I mean, the entitlement problem in the States, it's broken.
Mm-hmm. So what do, like, Mike, I think about this and I've like, I'm of two minds, right? The Bitcoiner side of me says, If the government has to publicly bail out a pension the way that the UK just did, you know, and it happens in enough G7 economies, people are going to lose faith not only in the currency, which they really should have lost faith in the currency already, but let's say they haven't, okay? They're going to lose faith in the currency, then they're going to lose faith in the government. But then once you start losing faith in, you know, sort of the working years of your life, being able to provide the golden years, right? There is no retribution for lost time. And so you get this social unrest. And the Bitcoiner part of me is waiting for that to happen. I don't want it to happen, but it seems to me like the likely outcome. Maybe not in a place like Canada. You mentioned we're, you know, a bit apathetic, I think, you know, to a fault. But in places like America, Mike, you know, I look at that and I think these guys are already on the knife's edge when it comes to political tensions and whatnot. And if that happened over there, you know, that'd be a big deal. Now, the more rational side of me says the government's really been bailing out pensions probably in one way or another for 40 years. And whether they're doing it with inflationary measures, fiscal response, whatever the case is, right? Whether they're fudging the CPI numbers so that all the indexed municipal and federal pensions don't have to keep up, they're doing something, right, to bail these pensions out. And so why is this going to be any different? Do you have a view on whether this is the straw that, you know, I don't want to say breaks camel's back, but leads to more public outrage? This is going to be the first time this happens where there's, you know, 100 million people on Twitter and 100 million people on Facebook. There's podcasts to listen to. You don't have to go to the state stenographers, as I mentioned before, to get your information. Is this the one, or am I in La La Land?
No, I think you're right on. First of all, my overview of every economic issue and social issue is confidence. And what I've chronicled for years is measuring the declining confidence in government. It's not a small deal when you see that politicians and journalists, for example, and other occupations are at the low scale of confidence. Our entire system works on confidence, 100% though. Like, they can't police all of us. So they are, you know, if I lose confidence, and we're seeing that right now, currently. And one of the things I've been chronicling is that for example, we knew that this was the era of anti-establishment, but it's all about, I've lost confidence. Well, we saw that with the yellow vests. So that was a big check mark for me, the yellow vests in France. Mm-hmm. Oh, pro-democracy in Hong Kong. The list of around the world, you cannot allow Canada to color your view. We are complacent that way. Look around the world. It's unbelievable right now. I mean, the truckers convoy, again, I'm not discussing whether you like it, don't like it, all of that stuff. It was part of a bigger lack of confidence trend. And I'll come back to, just remind me to come back to one thing about that convoy. That's huge for Bitcoin. Huge. Okay. But you looked around. All I look around is chronicling the lack of confidence. So let me tell you about what's happening now. Because it's just, you know, we have maybe some people here who are not keen on government in general listening. Okay, how about this? They're hunting them down in Ecuador. Hunt. That's the word. Not discovering them. They're hunting and killing. How about Sri Lanka? Took the advice of the World Economic Forum and they went to organic farming. The rice yield dropped 30% in 1 year. Well, that's their food crop. Mm-hmm. Their tea yield, that's their biggest export, 18%. So I continue to ask audiences now, if you could choose two variables to create social unrest, can you come up with two better than energy and food? I mean, people not affording energy, people not affording food is huge. So we're in that period of social unrest already. I mean, this is a major check mark for sort of the theme that I was observing of declining confidence. Major checkpoint, though. Like, you have so many countries where your inflation rate is 30, 40, 50%. They can't import energy. Countries that are importing energy out of the emerging market are doomed. Importing fertilizer are doomed. It's over already. Like we're saying, we're done. We're just waiting to see, you know, the body count. Then you get into the West. Well, our theory has always been problems would start in emerging markets financially, spread to the weaker members of the sort of Western world, and then look out. And we've also been recommending the US dollar, though, for 8 years. Said any time that you have a problem or you get an opportunity, the Canadian dollar gets smart ass and gets a little too high for whatever reason, change it for US dollars. We're still in that period. But what it relates to what you were saying, Joey, is that when confidence leaves the US dollar, the game's over. That's when you're going to be loving to have gold or copper or oil, you know, whatever it is. It's the last paper dollar standing. And I know it's tough for people to see that, but I would say, look around. The euro used to be 150. Mm-hmm. You know, it's under a buck. Look at Turkey, down 50, the lira, 50% in 1 year. They can't buy energy, you know, and you can't do two things more motivating than to put food and oil or any energy. Okay, so the last thing you asked about pensions. I've often thought pensions will be the last straw. Don't pay a pension and you got a problem. That's the North America checkpoint, the welfare state model checkpoint. Stop paying pensions and you have a real social problem on your hands. That's why I think what we have to anticipate is governments and central banks will do anything to protect the system. Anything goes. I heard of a country north of the United States that actually froze bank accounts without charging people. And if you don't think that was noticed around the world, you know, people are wrong. Much bigger event outside of Canada than in, when they said, we'll freeze bank accounts. You can't have access. Oh, no, you're not charged with anything. You have no recourse. That was a major moment. I know just tons of analysts who would sort of think in that broad terms, still can't believe it.
Really?
But yeah. So, you know, when you... So the choice will be, some pensions will be in trouble. What will they do? My thing is the government, in fact, will bail them out because of social unrest that would come. Then what's the implication? Is that your paper currency is worth even less in purchasing power.
Did you want to add a comment about Bitcoin and the convoy? I think you mentioned that
when you
started there. Yeah,
that it relates to the freezing of bank accounts. If anybody sat there and said, you know, Bitcoin is the one that's sort of, speaking of last standing, what were there, 12,000 cryptos?
Something like that.
So Bitcoin is sort of risen to the top. You know, it doesn't matter that in some eyes it gets colored with all of the problems, you know, including in digital finance problems or somebody's doing a fraud or whatever. But it is still, in my opinion, considered sort of the top choice, the choice when it comes to that. So you've got people sitting there going, geez, I don't trust the government. Well, could we ever give them a bigger reason not to trust? I mean, that was the best advertising for all of the characteristics that maybe will mature in Bitcoin possible. I mean, that was a really big time event, and it comes at the same time that Western governments are freezing the assets of oligarchs and Russian, you know, Russian central bank, et cetera. That's right filed under governments will do anything.
And they'll do anything possible to make sure that they're still in power. And
yes. Yeah.
That's the reality of it. I want to double back to the pension thing and the environment we're in. You know, we are all addicted to cheap credit, not just globally, nationally, but even individually we are. And even if you want to look at a little bit more in depth, there's all these zombie companies out there that continually get bailed out. And the environment that we're in, you know, currencies are losing value against the US dollar, rates are going up, and so is unemployment. And things are just totally out of whack. You look at the yield curve, for instance, and that just gives you an indication of what's going on. You talked about lack of confidence. What about lack of skill and lack of knowledge? And given the fact we've been in this environment for so very long, do the people managing the pension plans, heck, even people managing budgets, do they have the ability, the knowledge, the skill to actually fix the problem? Given that they've worked in this environment for so very long, they only know this environment. So are we just screwed or is there hope?
Well, first of all, you come right down to the individual. I mean, one of the only thing I've been trying to do is protect individuals. You know, so for example, we do a financial conference every year, early February. Number one recommendation coming out of 220 that was clearly stated then and 312 times, because if there's one thing I'm good at besides blabbering on, it's repeating myself. So it was to lock in. The biggest danger was in sovereign debt. So again, I don't think it took a lot of brains to say, hey, we're at about a 5,000 year low. You might want to lock in and not try and snip the last quarter point out of it. You know, so that was the first thing, that debt would actually be a big danger for individuals. Now we've moved into a stage where protecting your purchasing power is the number one goal. That's it. And if someone can help you with that because they've got a track record, yeah, I'll listen to them. I mean, for sure I will. I'm not casual about that. Mm-hmm. That's who I want to hear from. Now, can governments do that? I think they work at cross purposes to us. I don't think their goal at all is to protect my purchasing power. We're sitting at a period of time right now, and think about it. So if you said to me, geez, all my assets are pretty much my home. Oh, yeah, and I've got an RSP. Yeah, I've got that. And I'm saying, well, you realize the central bank's goal, it's not a byproduct. The goal is to make you feel terrible about what you own. It's called the reverse wealth effect. Their little goal was to say, when you feel poor, you will not spend. You will not go out there and push the price of things up because you're out there buying. So in the last 7 months, keep in mind, their bank rate's up 1,300%. Mm-hmm. Nobody in the Bank of Canada sitting there going, what a surprise. The housing just took a heck of a beating. And the stocks, who would have seen that coming? They knew exactly what was happening. They literally had the goal of reducing your feelings about your financial situation. And I mean, I've been a product of that. I watch what's going on and I go, well, geez, maybe I shouldn't buy that big ticket item. And I got about 50% of Canadians saying the same thing. Maybe I should put off that vacation. Well, I got 40% of Canadians, according to the recent polls, telling me the same thing. That's exactly what they wanted to happen. They wanted me to say, I'm not going to go buy something. Well, so we have to keep in mind that they're not going to help us in any way. Like, we're just cannon fodder in this big picture. They were warned about the amount of money they were printing up. They're warned about the record low rates. My criticism is they should have started some program 6 to 8 months earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it wasn't a shock. But once we got here, their goal was to shock. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's done. It's not that say a 4.5% 5-year mortgage rate is scary. We've had much higher. What's scary is it came in 7 months. You know, that's 11 years combined previous, you know. So yeah, I think my message is much more, I'm not looking for those people to help me. I'm looking to make the right sort of big picture decisions that now I can be wrong, but I've identified that the number one goal is to protect your purchasing power. Have to do it. And so now we discuss, how do you do that? I think when the US dollar, the party's over, like up to this point, I've been saying US dollar. But when the party's over for the US dollar, and it will be over, oh, well, then what do I want to own? Well, I also like commodities. I mean, that was the name of our conference in February 2020, where we called it the coming commodity boom. You know, I was shocked when oil went negative because they didn't have the storage capacity. That's but right. I did say also, and our people and the people we feature said very clearly, by the fall, you got to own oil because there's an energy problem brewing. So I still like some commodities. I like the renewable energy commodities because that's going through no matter what, you know. So they are going to push copper's price up at some point. They are going to push nickel, you know. So, yeah, I just see the debate is, sorry, I'm going on and on because I'm trying to.
No problem.
I'm trying to think about how to express it clearly. So I say, close your eyes. 5 years from now, do you want to own paper dollars or do you want to own oil, copper, nickel?
We know gold. The answer. We know the answer. Yeah, of course. Of course.
So that is the question. So it's not going to be about who helps me. It's going to be, I'm going to be in the right stuff.
So Mike, first of all, you've been an outstanding guest. You apologize for going on way too many times, okay? Because one thing we try and encourage people on this program to do is go downhill. And sometimes, Mike, it's not that easy. You got to really give people a prompt that they like before they take the ball and run. You've been running the whole time. Now, I want to get you out of here on one last question. You've mentioned a few times you're longer in the tooth than Len and I. This is true, okay? Nothing wrong with that. I want to know, and I'm asking this question because I listened to Money Talks, I think about a month ago. I mean, I listen all the time, but about a month ago when you were recounting the 72 Summit Series.
Yes.
And that was an important cultural moment in Canadian history. Now, unfortunately for me, I wasn't alive to experience that, but still as a Canadian, you know, I was a hockey player when I was a kid. Everyone knows about that series. In your view, Mike, what is the, apart from the 72 Series, which I know is top of your list, what is the most important Canadian sports moment in your lifetime, and why is it the 2018 Toronto Raptors NBA championship? Go ahead, floor is
Joe Carter hitting a home run.
No,
we have several of these great moments, though. Eh? I mean, it's interesting how that happens. 3 a.m. in the morning in Rome at a conference, I'm watching the Raptors, I'm watching Kawhi Leonard. 3 a.m., and I'm speaking the next morning. I couldn't have cared less. I got a Raptors game. To me, I go to the Olympics too, though. You know, there's so many Olympic moments that were chilling. And I mean, I was really loving the 2010 Olympics because I wanted us to win. I wanted us to do well, you know. So, I mean, some of those moments are etched in people's mind, you know, Alexander Bilodeau winning the first gold medal, you know, and his brother and him, you know, hugging. I do a lot with Special Olympics, and I know generally about, you know, athletes like that, but hugging his brother. I was actually... There's a lot you can imagine with me, guys, a 1 hour story about how I ended up at that final game, thanks to my son at the time, he was about 25, who said, let's get tickets. I said, no, we can't afford tickets. He goes, oh, that's the price you put on a thrill of a lifetime. Like there was a lot of latent guilt laid there. Anyways, I was there for the, you know, Crosby goal, you know, at the end. And I thought that was a very important moment that united us. But I also remember watching in Raptor with the Atlanta Olympics in 96 and Donovan Bailey, mm-hmm. you know, winning there, that meant a lot. So it is interesting how, and there's so many more. So I apologize. I could go on. Believe me, I could. So many more moments. And it's interesting how sports does galvanize us, you know, that we are tribal in nature. People are tribal in nature. And when it comes on the world stage, our tribe is Canada. No matter what else we think about the individual politics of the moment or the leader of the day or whoever it was, I think most of us still, you know, when you scratch the surface, there's a maple leaf there.
No mention of when Lemieux scored a goal in 1987. That was a good one.
Another good one.
That was brilliant, though. I mean, of course, with Gretzky and him playing together for the
same line. You know. And no mention of Wendell Clark scoring the game-tying goal in Game 6 in L.A. They eventually lost the series in L.A.
That is not a uniting moment. The last one is not a uniting moment.
We were cheering hard that day.
That was a tribal moment. You know? a wonderful thing for the tribe, but no, that was not. not. Look, you know, Vancouver, Vancouver Canucks, we don't have much to cheer about. You know, we don't have a Stanley Cup. So, but yeah, it is fascinating. There are so many moments. That's what you say. I never forget. I couldn't believe that Lemieux didn't pass it on that last shot. Boy, you're good when you've got somebody wide open with an open net. You say, nah, I think I'll shoot that. I think I'll just put that in the top corner.
That's what makes him great. That's what makes him great.
Absolutely.
Mike, you've been an outstanding guest. For people who don't know, because I didn't know about your show about a year ago, and now I'm hooked. It's a must listen for me. It's in my rotation every week. Tell people where they can hear you. Your guests are great. You share a lot of the same views that we have, and it's really a good way to spend a Saturday morning listening to Money Talk. So tell people where they can find it.
Well, I think the easiest way is, you know, of course, it's the podcast is on everybody, the normal stuff you can get. But I think you go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. And it's right there, right in the front. Click anytime. You can listen. I love it that you can listen to it anytime. I mean, I get people listening to shows 3 weeks later. Like they'll say, I like that interview. And I'm going, when was that anyways? You know, 1962. But that's the easiest way. Mikesmoneytalks.ca. Thanks.
Outstanding. Mike.
Oh, you can join us on Twitter. I'll tell you what I like about I'm doing.
You don't tweet enough, Mike. Like you got all this stuff to say. You don't tweet enough. You got to tweet more. We need like at least 5-10 tweets a day from you, man.
Okay, I think I might be at 5, but the thing I'm concerned about is my goal on Money Talks is not to have you think anything I think, not to change anybody's opinion. I think it's key to have the information. And I think we're living in an era where a lot of that information is kept from us. A lot of it's not followed up, maybe because they're not understanding it. You know, but that's the thing I'm keen about Money Talks tweets and Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook is that we get to put out a ton of info that I just know people aren't seeing anywhere else or aren't seeing in the mainstream, I should say.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. Thanks for listening, everyone. Chat was very busy tonight. This will be out audio only in about a week and we'll talk to you later.
Take care.
Mike, that was awesome, man. I.